You didn't hear this from me, but Normal Gossip is back for a sixth season. Join host Kelsey McKinney as she shares the juiciest gossip from the real world. Each episode, she's joined by a special guest, and you might recognize a couple this season from the Radiotopia universe. Normal Gossip, named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, is out now on all your favorite podcast platforms. New episodes starting April 17th.
Welcome to The Heart. I'm Caitlin Prest. Every year, there is this magical audio festival called the Third Coast International Audio Festival, where the best work in the industry gets recognized. Mitra and I go every year, and this year we came back with gold. Like, best documentary of the year gold. The piece that we won for was the one that we worked on with Maria Karimji about her personal experience of pursuing a sex life after FGM. Her story, that was originally published under the title Damage, has gone farther than any of us could have ever hoped. Not only did it go on to This American Life, an award, a book deal for Maria, but publishing this story propelled Maria into being a resource in her community and beyond her community, even, for women who had experienced the same thing but never talked about it.
Hello.
Hi.
We called Maria so that we could be excited and congratulate each other and talk about how it's been for her since she made the piece.
Yay!
Yay!
Congratulations!
Congratulations!
Yay! Yeah, guys, congratulations to you.
We did it.
So I was staying at this like fantastic like communal living space in Bali. And when I found out that I had won, I was like really excited. And I told like literally the first person I saw, I was like, oh my God, guys. And they were like, what are you even talking about? But then there was a woman that I had the opportunity to meet who was Indonesian. And she got online and saw the piece. And she was like, wait, what? Like, I had no idea this was like a thing that happened in Pakistan. This happened to me. And so she sat and like listened to probably like the first 3.5 minutes on her own. And then she ended up calling a bunch of her friends and like was like, we should all listen to this together. And so we all sat in a room and listened to the piece together. And it was like so cathartic. And like they all kind of shared their stories. And it's like talking to them and kind of like hearing how much it meant to them as well. That was really awesome.
That's amazing. Whoa. Tell us like how it's been since we made it together. Like, how has making this story changed your life?
For a while, I got really worried that this is going to be like the only story that I got to tell, like that no one would ever want to hear anything else about me which is hard. Like, I think there's a lot of stuff in my life that I think is worthy of being told as a story. And I don't want to be like that FGM girl. Plus, like, it's hard to date when people can Google you and then like your like trauma is front and center. Like, before you ever meet them for a date, they will know this about you, you know? Like, things I did not think about before publishing this story. Like, literally the predictive text is like Maria Karimji FGM. Like, I don't have the option of not having that person know that. Like, everyone Googles people before they go on dates. Like, that's a thing, right? Like, this is the first thing that anyone is ever gonna see about me. But like, every time something happens with a story, like whether it's like winning an award or whether it's like, you know, re-airing on NPR or if it's like a short clip about whatever happened, or it's like people from like all over the world are emailing me from all different cultures to be like, thank you for your story or whatever. And I'm always like, oh yeah, you did do the right thing.
And now I present to you the award-winning piece, Maria. This is an extended version with some of our favorite scenes that we cut out of the original version.
The one and only time I tried to have sex, it really did not go well. I had been dating my boyfriend, Ryan, for about 1.5 years. And I told him this, that he shouldn't stop even if it looked like I was in pain. I'd been practicing. I watched tons of porn just so that I would understand the mechanics of it. And we opened up a bottle of red wine, and I drank way more wine than I normally do. All of my limbs kind of felt like jelly, and we were making out on the couch. We moved from the couch to the bed, and by the time we were in bed, both of us were naked. I told him that I was ready, and he reached for a condom. He put the condom on, and then he asked me several times if I was sure if I was ready. And I nodded, and I said yes. And I finally started getting frustrated, and I said, come on, just do it. After like a second or two of him entering me, I felt this new, different pain, and I knew that it was like not normal. And as he began thrusting, it felt like my insides were being scraped out by sandpaper. You could feel that in my teeth, like in the bottom of my jaw. And I just like quietly laid there for a while. And then he just like withdrew himself, left to go to the bathroom to finish jerking off or whatever, which was something that happened frequently because we would get hot and heavy and then I would just be done. And he had to, you know, go and relieve himself. And when he did that for the first time, I like began to cry in my bed. I wanted to call my mom. She was the only person I trusted to tell me the truth about having sex with a part of your clitoris missing. My name is Maria Karimji, and when I was 7 years old, living in Karachi, Pakistan, someone cut out a small but significant part of me. When I was 7, my mom told me that I had a bug growing inside of me that needed to be removed. And so she said that we would go and I had to be really brave. And my grandmother told me, oh, you know, so-and-so down the street also got hers removed. And she was like so happy afterwards and felt so good. And it barely hurt her. And she jumped up and down and but the night before the operation, I got scared. I didn't like the idea that there was a bug inside of me that someone would have to cut out. So I laid in bed thinking, be gone, bug.
Be gone, bug.
Be gone, bug. And then I went to this lady's house, and there were like several women that I didn't know there. All of the furniture had kind of been moved to the side of the room. And she had like laid a rust-colored tarp. It was just covered in blood. She removed my pants and underwear and then cut me. And there's like a gush of like fluid, so which was most likely blood, but I didn't really know. And it felt like I'd peed myself. She definitely like held up like a small, tiny pink nub of like flesh. I was a morbid child, so I like remember asking to see the bug because I was like, how is there a bug inside of me? And I just remember thinking that that does not look like a bug at all. When I was 11, my family moved from Karachi to Texas. We lived in a two-story house in a neighborhood built around the gorgeous long pine trees that had been there for years. I love the house. I love that it had a Juliet balcony over the foyer so that you could see people from the top story when they walked in the house. I love the fact that the stairs were carpeted so that you could slide down on its tray if my brother and I were feeling particularly rambunctious. I was 15 and I was in mosque outside of Houston, and I heard women talking about whether or whether or not their daughters had been cut. And all of a sudden I remembered, it just came flooding back to me, this memory of being in some lady's house on her floor and her cutting me, like a memory that I didn't even remember that I had until that moment. I like waited up until everyone in my house was like mostly asleep. Our computer was like one of those old, it was like a Compaq. that cream-colored monitor. And so it was in, like, the corner of the game room, which is basically where my family spent all of their time. So I waited until, like, I had the computer to myself and, like, no one was there. And I searched online.
Cutting vaginal area.
I don't know, like, what I put in, like, what I searched exactly.
Muslim, Islam, cutting.
But eventually the end result of what I found was that there was a thing called female genital mutilation.
Female genital circumcision. Female genital cutting. Clitorectomy.
Where people cut out a large chunk or a small chunk or, you know, the entirety of a woman's clitoris as part of a cultural practice. All of the articles that I read, for the most part, described it happening in, like, African tribes. And they, like, debated the difference between, like, female genital circumcision or female genital cutting or female genital mutilation. But the more that I thought about what was happening and the more that I, like read about what was happening, I kind of, like, glommed on to the FGM. Like, I thought that it was, like, a really violent word. And I thought that it, like, more aptly described this, like, extremely violent, horrific memory that I had. And that circumcision made it sound too clinical and that cutting made it sound too mild. I wanted to figure out if it was a Muslim practice. So I Googled Islam FGM. And what I found was just article after article saying that, like, it wasn't an Islamic practice. When I Googled the specific name of my sect, an FGM, Dawoodi Bora plus FGM, I found, like, forum threads that, like, debated whether or not it was happening in the Bora community. And, like, most of the forums were written by men. And so that was, like, pretty good confirmation that, like, I hadn't made up the memory. The overwhelming feeling that I, like, took away from that was how just alone I felt. I didn't really have anyone else that I could speak to about it. I was in a super, super white high school in the suburbs of Texas, and I was already different enough. So after this internet exploration, I was, like, sitting on the floor of my room. I had these floor-to-ceiling bookshelves in my bedroom, and I looked up and I saw, like, the copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves that my aunt had bought me. So I took out the book and I flipped through it, and it gave some pretty, like, detailed instructions, just kind of, like, looking at yourself and familiarizing yourself with your lady bits. And so I had, like, a hand mirror, and I took that into the bathroom with me, and I put it between my knees and just, like, looked. And the book is pretty explicit. So it has these, like, really actually beautiful pencil drawings of different types of vaginas. But what became really, really apparent to me is that what I had did not look anything like what they had. I feel like it could have been days, or it could have been months, or it could have been weeks. My mom and I were cleaning in the bathroom, and all I could think about, like, literally all I could think about, was the fact that my mother had taken me to this lady's house, and, like, that's where it happened, and that she was there and she knew about it. And the bathtub was, like, spotless. There was, like, literally nothing else that I could clean in the bathtub. And I was standing there, and I was holding the steel wall, and I just looked at my mom, and I was just like, what exactly was that butt thing that you told me about? Just exactly like that. Like, just one long, drawn out, not understandable word. She knew exactly what I'd asked her, and she just, like, was so surprised and so thrown off. You remove the part of me that makes me feel good while having sex. She said, like, all 7-year-old Bora girls go through this. And I said, yeah, but, like, we didn't have a choice, or something like that. And she was like, well, I didn't have a choice when it happened to me. And I just remember being like, what is wrong with you? Like, why would you think that you not having a choice would make it any better that I don't have a choice? Like, you didn't have the choice, so you took that choice away from me. Like, I just slammed the door shut in her face, which, like, by the way, was, like, a no-no in my house. And then she didn't, like, come after me. Like, she didn't open the door. She didn't yell at me for slamming the door shut. Like, None of that. Until that moment, I had no idea that I could even get that angry, that much anger could exist.
His lips lay lightly on hers, but that was somehow more unnerving than the night she'd sensed his fierce desire. He took her hand, still raised in an instinctive gesture of resistance. "Kiss me back," he murmured against her lips.
I had developed this weird addiction to Harlequin novels.
Almost the ghost of a kiss, but a ghost that was enfolding her in a mysterious spell.
They were fun and sexy and kind of, sweet and sappy and romantic. And
the slow movement of his lips over hers was sweet, blissful, and the temptation to believe it was overpowering.
I hid them underneath my bed.
His eyes fixed on her with a kind of astonishment. He was breathing unevenly.
But one day my mom walked into my room while I was reading one, and I literally just shoved it under my covers. And she didn't address it, and we just kind of pretended that she hadn't seen me do it for a while. But my mom has this amazing habit of bringing up super intense conversations you don't want to have with her while she's driving you somewhere, so you can't escape out of the car or whatever. She did that while she was driving me somewhere, and she told me that just straight up, sex isn't what you read about in the Harlequin novels. The movies are lying, the books are lying. She told me that the books never tell us what it feels like when a man is selfish, when he's able to find his pleasure quickly. For us, it's different, is what my mom told me. I wondered, did she mean women when she said us, or did she mean the two of us specifically? After I graduated from high school in 2006, I moved to Western Massachusetts to go to a fancy liberal arts all-women's college. It was very, very different from where I lived in Texas. I mean, these girls had hairy armpits, didn't put on makeup every morning, went to class in their pajamas, talked about feminism and women's liberation and just so many different things that I'd never even heard about before. It was a culture shock, to say the least. I had this roommate who we'll call Mary, and we mostly kept to ourselves. We'd been living together for a few months, and I walk in and here's Mary masturbating. And instead of being embarrassed, she just kind of slowly takes her hand out of her crotch and then just smirks at me. And I'm like, what just happened? Oh my gosh. And I definitely saw her facial expression as a challenge, bring it up, I dare you. And then I obviously didn't. And then later that day, she tried to talk to me about masturbation. She's sort of my, oppressed Muslim Texas roommate who doesn't know anything about the female body, blah, 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 blah. Asked me if I masturbated, and I was no. And then she got, I would say, aggressive about the whole thing. And she's like, you should try it. Don't be such a prude. And I just went from 0 to 60, just started bawling. She was the first person that I really talked about my FGM with. And I told her that I didn't know what it meant, that I had a lot of anxiety about it, that I was pretty sure that I didn't have the parts that would allow me to masturbate. And she comforted me all night. She was very, very nice about it. It didn't really mean that afterwards that we were any closer, but she would come in with pamphlets about the women's health services on campus and so on and so forth, encouraging me to go see a doctor and talk about it with a medical professional. I booked an appointment with a gynecologist at Student Health Services after months of delaying that. And I went there by myself. I didn't tell anyone that I was going. And when I got there, the nurse kind of explained, take off your clothes, wear this gown, sit on this table, bed thingy and like, here are the stirrups and like, you know, your heels go in here and like sit here and the doctor will like come and see you. So I was like sitting there in a gown with my feet in the stirrups and the doctor came in and she like put on her gloves like as she walked in and she was like, let's take a look and see what's going on or something like that. And then like walked over and she like pulled out like a rolly stool that was pretty low and she like sat on it and then scooted towards like my knees so she could see things. And like right as soon as she like got closer, I like clamped my knees shut and like pulled my feet out of the stirrups and started crying, just like uncontrollable sobbing. And she had like, I guess, seen enough to have seen what was going on. But she like stood up, she took off the gloves, said, okay, and like, let's talk this through. Like, what did you want to accomplish? Like, is there anything else that I should know about? And then kind of skirted around the fact that she had like been able to see that I had been cut. And then so that she really just didn't have any experience or expertise and she's really out of her depth and she would help me find other resources if I wanted that. I asked her if she thought that I could have like good sex and she just was like, I really, really don't know enough to be able to tell you. Before my junior year in college, my family's green card application was denied and we ended up having to move back to Pakistan while I was still in college. As a result of that, I took a study abroad year in Cairo, which is where I met Ryan. We got to be really good friends and that eventually morphed into something more. After that year, the study abroad year ended, I went back to Western Mass and he went back to college in DC and we decided to try and make the long distance thing work. I went to go visit him in DC one weekend. I drank like way too much green apple vodka, puked half of that up that night or the next morning. While I was drunk, I told him about FGM. He definitely knew that I had like some issues, most of which I had like sort of like ascribed to the fact that I came from a super like sexually repressed culture, which is like not necessarily entirely true. And then later he like, I don't know, tried to go down on me and like saw my vagina and said that it was really beautiful down there, like maybe to comfort me because it looked so different, or maybe because he like did actually think that it looked better, because like, who knows? But it was like one of the most offensive things I've ever heard about it. And I just like put my clothes back on and then went to the couch and slept on it. And like after that, I like had a really hard time like sleeping or being naked anywhere around him just because I was like so uncomfortable with the way that he had like commented on my body. The nice thing about Ryan was that he was just extremely patient and extremely kind and never forced me or pressured me or even kind of like moved the conversation into a pressuring place when it came to sex. And I went to an all-women's college, so like frankly, like the amount of like choices I had for boyfriends was severely limited. But he was just so sweet and so kind. Like, he was just such a kind person that I really did like at some level know that I could like use him to see whether I'd ever have success at a relationship, even if I wasn't ever ready to have sex. And during the 3 or so days before I finally did have that awful red wine sex with him, the only person I wanted to talk to about it was my mother. There wasn't anyone else in my life that I trusted to tell me the truth about what it was like to have sex without like a large part of your clitoris. But at the same time, I didn't know if I was ready or ever going to be ready to hear that my mother had potentially never had good sex or had never found a way to like enjoy sex. And I also didn't know if like hearing that would make me think that that was also going to be my future. After Ryan and my horrible attempt at sex, I was crying on the bed and he was like telling me that he loved me and trying to leave, to give me my space, to go to the bar. And after he left the room, I waited like less than a minute before opening up my computer and Skyping my mom in Pakistan. According to like my Skype credit, I had exactly 23 minutes to speak to her. And as it rang, as the phone rang, I had like come up with like 6 or 7 different things that I wanted to say to her. But when she answered the phone, the first thing that I said was, "Is sex ever good for you?" And my mother said, "Excuse me?" And then I heard nothing. And then the door clicked shut, like she had gone into like a private space to actually like have this conversation. And then I kind of just word vomited everything that had happened, that I tried to have sex, that it was bad, that I was miserable, that I was scared, that I like, I don't know if I will ever be able to have sex or whatever. And my mother was great. She didn't like at all at any point in the conversation be like, "You're Muslim, don't have sex before marriage," or anything like that. But she did tell me that she was scared of sex too, that she had also, you know, very romanticized, idealized idea of sex because she...
His tongue teased her on before starting a lazy exploration of her mouth.
She used to read Harlequin novels as well.
No other kiss had ever been so thrilling. Now she had to have him in every possible way. His mouth drifted down her neck and she drew in a long, shaking breath.
She told me that she had these super romanticized ideas about sex and she'd gotten them from, you know, reading Harlequin novels that made it sound like amazing and made women like completely overcome with desire and like...
Wherever he touched her, the result was electric, sending shivers of sensation everywhere along her arms, her legs, between her thighs.
And then when she first started, you know, after she got married and she and my father were trying to have sex, she would go from like being really, really into it to having like panic attacks when he got just close to areas that made her uncomfortable. And it took her a while to kind of be able to navigate that or to get to a point where she was comfortable enough with him. For her, it was like a conversation over like extended period of time that got her there. And then even still, like, she said that she would still have like relapses into panic attacks when they were like trying to do stuff. And that, but she did tell me that like she didn't like wasn't scared of sex anymore, but like she did figure out a way to have sex with my father. And then I saw that the timer was running out on my Skype clock, so I told her that I had to go and that we'd talk later, bye, which was our standard goodbye. And like right as I was trying to hang up the phone, she just was like, "I hate them all too, you know." And I said, "What?" And she's like, "All those women who do enjoy sex or say they enjoy sex or like think they can enjoy sex, I hate them all too." And I just got off the phone and I was like, wow. And at that moment, I was like, this is definitely going to be the closest thing to an apology I ever get from my mother for the fact that like she had me cut when I was a kid. About a year after Ryan and I had sex for like the one and only time, we broke up and I moved to Boston to work. A few months into my job in Boston, I did something that I've never done before, or like after, to be quite honest. I started making out with this guy in my workplace. We would make out all the time in the downstairs supply closet. One of the times we were making out, it was honestly, it was like one of the few first times that I truly understood what like sexual desire was about. And I was entirely turned on in that moment and I wanted it really, really badly in a way that I had kind of really never wanted it with Ryan. And I was pressed up against him entirely. Then his hand just skirted its way inside of my shirt, and I, like, moving up towards my breast, and I just kind of, like, went, like, cold and clammy and, like, just felt so disgusted. And I almost, like, puking, and I clearly, like, dead fished him. So he started making, like, stopped, and then he was like, okay, like, clearly we're done here. And then we, like, both went upstairs and, like, started to work. And then I, like, never made out with him ever again. This is the first time in my life that I was around people who candidly, like, talked about their sexual encounters. I wanted to be that person that was thought of as being, like, sexually liberal, but I also had no, like, personal experience to talk about. So then when my friends would talk about, like, their sexual escapades, I would just, like, join in with my own fake ones. So when my friends would be like, oh, I hate it when, you know, guys go down on you and you get so close to an orgasm and they just, like, shift a little bit and then you, like, lose the orgasm, I would, like, pretend like I knew what was happening. Or I would talk about how, like, I had gagged really badly while trying to give some guy a blowjob and all of that. And I would just have these conversations and I would sound so confident and I'd be giving, like, advice, like, willy-nilly to people, even though, like, a guy had only ever gone down on me once and it hurt so much that I cried. That was not a thing that I was talking about. I was just pretending that I was, like, normal. And it was extra confusing because, like, most of these people knew that I had been cut, but they were, like, all very happy to kind of just, like, pretend along with me. It was around this time that I decided that I needed to see a professional. So I booked an appointment with a specialist that I had heard about for years. Someone who, like, had, like, kind of created this clinic where she saw a lot of women that had FGM, had been cut, who were victims of FGM or survivors of FGM, whichever one you want. And I called her office. I didn't have health insurance that year, so I figured out what the, like, cost would be. For the first time in my life, it was like, oh, like, a doctor who's, like, actually qualified to treat me, you know? She didn't say something offensive. She didn't, like, try and comfort me when I didn't want comforting or whatever. She was just, like, very, like, professional about it, asked me questions, and then told me that, like, it really just, like, wasn't that terrible, that it could have been so much worse, and that, like, women in my community, specifically in my sect, a lot of them just had a varying, like, trauma or cutting, like, both physical and psychological trauma. And she said, like, find someone you love, like, start going to a sex therapist. Like, this is not terminal. Like, you don't have a life sentence on never having sex. Like, I can't tell you if it's going to happen, but, like, I can tell you that it could happen or it could not happen. But you're just going to have to, like, work on it for, like, a large chunk of your life. And that, like, opens up a whole host of other questions. At what point do I, like, bring up FGM? At what point do, like, should I get a sex therapist once I find a guy or, like, before I find a guy? There's a lot of fear about, like, whether or whether not I even know how to date. Like, what happens if a guy wants to go home on a third date and I really, really like him? Like, do I just, like, tell him, like, hey, look, like, waist up only, right? And not specify why. Like, are guys going to think that's weird in New York where, like, the general idea in my head that exists is that, like, everyone has tons of sex always and it's, like, really not a thing. And it's weird if you're, like, still, like, basically a virgin, which is what I kind of feel like I am. I worry that eventually, like, I'm not going to be able to deliver and then everyone's going to get bored and be like, whoa, you're, like, way too much work. Soon after that doctor's visit, I moved back to Pakistan to work as a freelance journalist. I still live in Karachi. It's a weird place for me to have moved back to because while I'm definitely still Pakistani ethnically, I feel very, very westernized. The adjustment has been hard, even though I've been living there for 4 years. A few years into my move, I was spending some time with my grandmother when she brought up FGM. It was a weird conversation. I learned a few things from that conversation with her. For starters, I had no idea how little my grandmother understood about female anatomy. And I realized that probably she was not alone, that she had no understanding of a clitoris or female pleasure or organs that deliver pleasure. I also really understood that because no one talks about it, There's no real understanding of what FGM is or any conversations about consent or women's bodies or anything like that. The last thing that I learned from this conversation with my grandmother right when I was leaving her house is that my mother had actually tried to stop my FGM. It took me a little while to kind of bring this up with my mother, but when I did, my mother got really quiet. We were in her room. She was folding laundry. I was sitting on her bed, and she just kind of looked at me. Her voice went very, very quiet and very, very sad, and said, "I tried so, so very hard." Until that moment, she'd never told me that she'd fought it or tried to fight it, or and I realized how much guilt she'd probably carried with her for years about what she'd done and how little choice that she probably had in the matter. My mother didn't have Google. My mother didn't have sex ed. She didn't have a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves. Like, my mother could never have known what the clitoris was or what that was happening. When I think about it, and I think about that story about the bug that she told me, and a lot of my anger comes through the brainwashing of that story that might actually be something that women with less education do believe. I feel a lot of anger towards the fact that, like, we don't get to talk about it, and that once you do start talking about it, we're told over and over again that it's important for us to, like, keep quiet because we don't need our dirty laundry aired. I was told very explicitly before and after, like, immediately after, that I was, like, just straight up not allowed to talk about it ever. I try and have these conversations all the time. In my area of Karachi, I've become kind of like a little bit of a lightning rod where people already know who I am and how I feel. So a lot of times if they have questions or concerns or need to find other people who are making decisions about not having their daughters cut, a lot of them will reach out to me. It feels really good to be angry about, like, a cultural phenomenon versus, like, be angry at a person. Like, it's a different kind of anger. It's a very productive kind of anger. For 2016, my New Year's resolution was to, like, figure out how to have an orgasm by myself. In my head, I'm like, you will be able to have good, successful relationships if you believe that, like, you can enjoy sex. I went to a female friend in medical school who is going to be an OB-GYN. I took, like, a vagina selfie and then sent it to her. And she, like, sent it back with, like, annotations and, like, arrows and so on and so forth, color-coded, like, circles. And she was like, here's, like, scar tissue. Here's an area you shouldn't touch. But actually the most useful information that she gave me is that I could touch a different part of my vagina to stimulate, like, an area near it. So I didn't have to, like, direct contact. And that, like, it might take a little more exploration. But if I knew the parts that were, like, totally off limits or too sensitive, then I could work around them. So I worked on that for a while. I want to describe it as, like, a mosquito bite, which is, like, really annoying. You know, when you get a mosquito bite and you, like, itch it, it, like, feels really good. And then it continues to feel, like, the same amount of good while you're itching it until you, like, make yourself bleed. And then it, like, hurts along with, like, feeling itchy. So for me, that was a lot of, like, what, like, masturbation was like. Like, it felt good, but, like, the amount of good that it felt did not increase. And then recently, I was talking to someone who told me that I should, you know, see if there were, like, certain things that turned me on. And I was like, what? And they're like, you know, like, visual aids. And I was like, okay. Like, maybe this is really dumb, but, like, I really just didn't think that I needed visual aids. So she was like, most porn is bad, but I get really turned on watching gay porn. So you might want to try that because it's a lot of dudes, like, turning on other dudes and masculine, et cetera. And I was like, that's bizarre, but I will try anything at this point. And yeah, I did it. And, like, maybe that was, like, you know, one of the contributing factors, but I went from like level one to like level two. And then I like just lost it. Like, I don't understand like how else to explain it. Like, it felt really, really good. And then all of a sudden it was like no more good feeling. Like, it just went away and I had to like start back at like point zero. And at that point I was like too depressed and sad to like, you know, want to start again. I'm now telling everyone that I watch gay porn. Hi, guys. But the fact that like I have found a place in my body that like feels really good is already progress.
That was Maria, Third Coast Festival's gold for Best Documentary of the Year. What was really amazing about the Third Coast Festival this year is that almost every story that won was about women and sexuality or violence against women. And in the week of the awful election, it made me feel a great deal of hope. You should definitely go to Third Coast's website and check out the other amazing winners. They're all really important and really, really well made. This piece was produced by Mecha Kaboli and me, Caitlin Prest, with The Heart, Sharon Mashihi, Phoebe Wang, and Jen Ng. You can hear another version of it on This American Life and read the original essay called Damage at the Big Round Table. Make sure to keep your ears peeled for pieces by Maria on The Heart. We're already brainstorming. Also, we're taking a little break in December, getting ready for the next mini-season of shows that'll be coming in January. Of course, we are not going to leave you hanging without a Heart holiday special. So you can look forward to that. Thanks to MailChimp and the Knight Foundation for their continued support of Radiotopia. And thanks to AdZerk, the ad-serving software that helps Radiotopia in mysterious technological ways.
Radiotopia.